This lecture, Freemasons Hall, London, by Reverend N. Barker and Harry Mendoza, is the 15th of 20 lectures supplied to members of Quattu Coronati Correspondence Circle on audio cassette in 1989. Worshipful Brother Don Ray, the preceptor of the Linford Lodge of Research, was given permission for the transcription and including on the Linford website in July 2021. Copyright of the audio material is retained by Quattu Coronati Correspondence Circle.
This is the Reverend Neville Barker Crier.
And this is Harry Mendoza.
We're going to tell you something about the Masonic Peace Memorial, or to give it the name by which it's more widely known, Freemasons Hall, London. Thousands visit it, both Freemasons and non-Freemasons. Many whose lives are affected by it do not have the opportunity to do so. Comparatively few have any idea of its history or treasures. Hence this taped talk. Let's start by asking Harry to give us a brief history of the previous halls and how this one came to be built.
The first Grand Lodge was over 50 years old before a committee was set up to consider the possibility of a hall and offices designed solely for the purposes of Freemasonry. Until then, lodge meetings had taken place in taverns and, occasionally, city livery halls. In 1774, two houses in Great Queen Street were bought by Grand Lodge, and it was decided to build a hall for the purposes of Freemasonry in the garden of one of them. The other became the first Freemasons' Tavern in 1779. The foundation stone of the hall was laid in 1775. The building was completed and opened by the Grand Master, Lord Peter, on the 23rd of May, 1776.
Harry, the Grand Lodge of the Ancients had been set up some time before this. Where did they meet?
In taverns and, occasionally, livery halls, as did the members of the Premier Grand Lodge. There is no evidence that the Ancients ever built their own Freemason Hall.
What happened to the first hall?
It became too small, especially after the union of the two Grand Lodges in 1813.
This lecture, Freemasons Hall, London, by Reverend N. Barker and Harry Mendoza, is the 15th of 20 lectures supplied to members of Quattu Coronati Correspondence Circle on audio cassette in 1989. Worshipful Brother Don Ray, the preceptor of the Linford Lodge of Research, was given permission for the transcription and including on the Linford website in July 2021. Copyright of the audio material is retained by Quattu Coronati Correspondence Circle.
Some adjacent property had been purchased and extensions carried out, but things got worse as time went by, and a decision was taken to build a new hall. A decision had already been taken to separate the hall from the tavern.
When was the foundation of the second hall laid?
On the 27th of April, 1864. The hall was in operation 1 year later. But it wasn't long before further extensions became necessary. Large sums were spent on these extensions. On the 5th of May, 1883, a disastrous fire almost entirely destroyed the temple, and many portraits 1 year later. Amongst them, the Ark of the Covenant, which had been specially made in 1813. The Articles of Union were normally kept in there, but fortunately, at the time of the fire, they were in another part of the building and were not destroyed. After the fire, restoration and renovations took place.
What eventually happened to that building?
Like its predecessor, it was demolished. Grand Lodge had for some time been acquiring property adjoining the hall, no doubt with an eye to future development. The next step came just after the First World War. and a special Grand Lodge was held in 1919 for the purpose of thanksgiving and for the return of peace. The Grand Master, the Duke of Connaught, was ill and unable to attend. He sent a message saying that he wanted consideration given to a new central home for Freemasons as a memorial to those who were killed in the war. Much discussion took place on where the hall was to be built, in Great Queen Street or elsewhere. Fortunately, the last piece of land required became available, so that it was bought. There was now a really extensive site in Great Queen Street, and the decision was taken to stay and rebuild there. The name of the fund to which voluntary contributions were made was the Masonic Million Memorial Fund, £1 million being the expected cost of rebuilding.
Am I right in thinking that there was a competition to decide the architects who were to be responsible for the building, and that the foundation stone was laid in an unusual manner?
Yes, that's right. There was a competition. Regarding the laying of the foundation stone, it was not possible to perform that ceremony in a narrow street used by buses. The ceremony was performed by the pressing of a button in the Albert Hall, which lowered the foundation stone in Great Queen Street. Part of the building was ready for occupation 4 years later. As users of the old building moved into the new, so demolition of the old building began. The official opening date was the 19th of July, 1933.
Thanks, Harry, for that potted review. Now we have to say something about this wonderful building of ours. Let's start with saying that its main functions can be divided into three groups: administration, educational, and ceremonial. I'll deal first with administration. Practically the whole of the ground and mezzanine floors are taken up by administration staff. They deal with many subjects. Here are a few. The preparation and maintenance of all Masonic records of lodges, chapters, and members throughout the world owing allegiance to United Grand Lodge and the Supreme Grand Chapter of England. The preparation and distribution of all matters affecting the government of Grand Lodge and Grand Chapter and its subordinate lodges and chapters. That includes the Book of Constitutions, notes for guidance, bylaws, and the like. And then there are all matters concerning finance and investment relating to Grand Lodge and Grand Chapter. The board and the committee of general purposes, the quarterly communications of Grand Lodge, and the convocations of Supreme Grand Chapter, as well as an inquiry desk that deals with very many matters every day.
There are also the day-to-day matters concerning London lodges, aren't there? Unlike the provinces, London does not have its own administrative centre.
Indeed. And then there are external relations, that is, matters concerning other Grand Lodges and recognised Masonic bodies, and all matters concerning public relations. There is the award of Grand Rank, and senior and London Grand Rank, and the chapter equivalent. These ranks are awarded by the Grand Master or First Grand Principal, but all the administrative work connected therewith is done from this building. The publication of the Grand Secretary's newsletter, and the many matters relating to charity, both Masonic and non-Masonic, not to mention the organizing, letting and preparation of the 23 rooms let to individual lodges and chapters for their meetings or for lodges of instruction. the maintenance of the building, and the storage of all furniture and furnishings. Those are just some of the administrative tasks undertaken. The list is far from complete. To do all this requires a competent, first-class staff. The number of such staff is in the region of 175 to 200. I might add that the offices of Quattro Coronati Correspondence Circle Limited and the London Grand Rank Association are also now in the building. Each of these bodies, however, uses its own staff. They are quite independent of Grand Lodge.
What about the museum and library, Neville?
There's a really first-class museum and library, and every visitor should make time to have a look round. The library houses all our historic records and thousands of books, mainly Masonic, but also many reference books, Bibles, periodicals, pamphlets, early manuscript and printed rituals and other reading matter. The museum, on the other hand, has a marvellous collection of Masonic furniture, silver, regalia, jewels, tracing boards, portraits, certificates, and many other items of Masonic interest, belonging not only to our own constitution, but also to the Irish, Scottish, and indeed many other constitutions. The museum also contains other items which, though not Masonic and in no way connected with the craft, use emblems which are readily identifiable in Freemasonry. But perhaps, Harry, you could touch on a very important aspect of the museum and library, which are the exhibitions that they arrange.
Certainly. There is now a permanent exhibition on the history of English Freemasonry, which is open to Masons and non-Masons. It tells the story of English Freemasonry and is illustrated with documents, paintings, engravings, photographs, regalia, porcelain, glass and silver. It outlines the development of the crafts in England. An excellent brochure giving much useful information on the exhibits is also available. In addition to this permanent exhibition, there are other occasional exhibitions in the museum and library. The most recent was Humour in Freemasonry. It attracted many visitors and was very well received.
Another highly important function of the library, of course, is the service it provides in answering queries from all over the world. Our colleague, John Hamill, the present librarian, and author of an excellent book called The Craft, is extremely knowledgeable. And he has a small but first-class team to help him in the day-to-day work. In addition to answering questions from both members of the craft and non-Masons, the librarian is often called upon by the Grand Secretary for specific historical information, all of which he has to dig out and ensure for its accuracy. Nor should it be forgotten that it is members of the library staff that act as guides to visitors who want to see the Grand Temple, whether or not they are Freemasons. All in all, the museum and library offer a very valuable educational service.
That leads us on to the third function of Grand Lodge, what might be described as the ceremonial, by which I mean the Grand Temple with its vestibules and processional corridor, and the other temples that are rented to lodges and chapters for their meetings.
I'm so glad you're going to deal with these. There are, I think, 23 temples available, and according to the original specifications, I believe each of them was meant to be in the form of a double cube.
Well, only one, I think, meets this requirement. The temples vary in size. The smallest will seat about 30, and the largest, which has its walls lined with portraits of past grand masters, will seat about 460. Each has its own cloakroom and anteroom. Apart from the summer months, when few Masonic meetings are held in London, All the temples are in use from Monday to Friday, and some are also used on Saturdays. But now let us turn our attention to the Grand Temple, the vestibules, and the processional corridor. Much of what follows has been taken from an excellent book written by Right Worshipful Brother Sir James Stubbs, past Senior Grand Warden and past Grand Secretary, and Worshipful Brother Terence Horch, past Deputy Grand Superintendent of Works, who was the librarian and curator of the museum from 1973 to 1983. The book was published by the Library, Art and Publications Committee under the authority of the Board of General Purposes. It is well worth getting a copy. The first vestibule contains the War Memorial Shrine and Window. The design and ornamentation of the shrine incorporates symbols connected with the theme of peace and the attainment of eternal life. At the four corners of the shrine stand pairs of winged seraphim carrying golden trumpets. Across the front are four gilded figures portraying Moses the lawgiver, Joshua the warrior high priest, Solomon the wise, and St. George of England. Two of these are on each side of a roundel, which has an emblematic reminder that the soul of man rests ultimately in the hand of his Creator. The roll of honor of the First World War is displayed through an aperture on the top of the shrine, guarded by kneeling figures representing the fighting services. The theme of the stained glass memorial window over the shrine is the attainment of peace through sacrifice. On the walls of the vestibule and of the ground floor and entrance hall below it are recorded the names of those lodges which, by their support of the fund for the erection of the building, qualified for the hall stone jewel, still worn today by their master. Two columns of light flank the shrine and the window. The second vestibule provides an anteroom in which scrutineers check the credentials of those seeking admission to meetings of Grand Lodge, and in which brethren register their attendance at these and other meetings. The third vestibule is the anteroom to the Grand Temple. It is the most splendid of the three vestibules. Now, Neville, take us into the Grand Temple.
The Grand Temple doors are bronze. Each of the two doors is cast in one piece and measures 12 feet by 4 feet, or 3.66 meters by 1.22 meters. And each weighs 1.25 tons. They are so well balanced that they can be opened with one finger. The reliefs on the outward facing side of the doors depict historical events. The three lower panels on each door show scenes connected with the building of King Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem, and the top left and right-hand panels together, the procession for the dedication of the temple. The inscription at the foot is God's promise to King Solomon, as recorded in the first book of Kings, chapter 6, verse 12. The inner face of the doors presents an inward-looking, mystical, and symbolic design, full of spiritual significance, and in contrast to the historical theme on the outside. On either side is a seraph, the great six-winged seraphim of the vision of Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 2. At the top of the left-hand leaf is the symbol of the soul of man, resting in the hand of his Creator. And on the opposite door, the other hand of God holds the scales to weigh him in the balance. Below these symbols is what the artist called the starry girdle of purity, dividing things heavenly from those earthly. The latter being represented by a number of figures denoting various divinely inspired attributes of the human spirit. They include two pairs of figures. The one, David and Jonathan, symbolizing brotherly love, and the other two, soldiers of the First World War, symbolizing self-sacrifice and echoing the concept of the building as a war memorial. You should now stand with your back to the doors and survey the scene ahead. Harry, you tell us about what can now be seen.
The Grand Temple, the climax of the ceremonial suite, is a great meeting hall, 123 feet long, 90 feet wide, and 62 feet high, or 37 by 27 and a half by 19 meters. It seats approximately 1,700 persons. It is used for the quarterly communications of Grand Lodge, the three regular convocations of Supreme Grand Chapter, and the Craft annual investiture. Other recognized Masonic organizations also use it. Only on very rare occasions is it used for meetings of a private lodge or a chapter. One of the questions asked when this temple was being built was, should the temple be arranged on an exactly correct orientation? The answer was, orientation of the large temple and the large rooms is not necessary. In fact, the winning design oriented the Grand Temple east and west. The frieze of the four splay walls carries the 12 signs of the zodiac. These have no present-day Masonic significance, but are a nostalgic link with the two former Freemasons' halls, which featured them in their decoration, as did many other old Masonic buildings.
Having walked through the vestibules into the temple, Harry, I suggest we now sit down and look upwards to the ceiling. Its center is coffered, that is, sunk like an alcove, and is decorated to give the effect of a celestial canopy. In the center is a large radiating sun. The frieze is mosaic, the predominant colors being gold and blue. The ornamentation is most interesting. Tell us about it.
In the east, above the Grand Master's throne, between two Ionic pillars, as befits the Master's place in the lodge, is a representation of the Ark of the Covenant, upon which rests an open volume of the Sacred Law. This supports Jacob's ladder, reaching to the heavens, depicted here by a sun in splendor, enclosing something that looks like an elongated letter S. In fact, this is probably meant to be the Hebrew letter Yod, one of the sacred symbols of the Most High. On the ladder are a cross, an anchor, and a chalice, symbols representing the moral virtues of faith, hope, and charity. Flanking the columns are, on the dexter side, that is left as you look at it, King Solomon, crowned. And on the sinister side, that is the other side, Hiram. Some think this is Hiram, king of Tyre, since Hiram Abiff was not alive when the temple was completed. Others argue that since he is not crowned, he is meant to represent Hiram Abiff. They also make the point that in the opening of Grand Lodge, the Grand Master is said to represent the Royal Solomon, and the Deputy Grand Master, Hiram Abiff, Prince of Architects. These figures are flanked by two seven-branch candlesticks. In the west, above the senior warden's pedestal, flanked by two pillars of the Doric order, as one would expect in this position, is the 47th proposition, and above this is the moon. The figures of Euclid and Pythagoras are beside the columns, and standing by each of these is a stand upon which rests a flaming torch. In the south, above the junior warden's pedestal, is a sun in splendor, radiated, in the center of which is the all-seeing eye. Below this, on a red and gold background, is a pentalpha, the five-pointed star. These are flanked by pillars of the Corinthian order, as befits the junior warden. Behind is a youth driving a chariot, the horses being driven in a westerly direction. This is meant to represent Helios, the Greek sun god, driving his chariot across the heavens to mark the sun at its meridian. A similar design appears in the earliest engraving of the first Masonic constitutions. In the north are two pillars of the composite order, one bearing a terrestrial and the other a celestial globe. Between them are two interlaced triangles above the armorial bearings of the Duke of Connaught and Stafern, the Grand Master at the time the hall was built. The rough and perfect ashlars are also shown. Behind the pillars is St. George slaying the dragon, the triumph of good over evil. Below each of the mosaics are words making up verses from the first book of Chronicles, chapter 17, verses 12 to 14. Starting in the east and continuing in the south, west and north, we have, "He shall build me an house, and I will establish his throne forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. I will settle him in mine house, and in my kingdom for ever, and his throne shall be established forevermore."
Thank you, Harry. Completing the mosaic decoration on the frieze, we have the figures of temperance in the northeast, fortitude in the northwest, prudence in the southwest, and justice in the southeast. Much more could be said about this wonderful building, but we're running out of time. We would strongly advise you to make an effort to see it if you're in London. But whether or not you can visit it, do get a copy of the book we mentioned earlier. It's called Freemasons Hall. Apart from its interesting narrative, it has some really good coloured pictures. And talking of pictures, you can purchase a box of 12 coloured slides, which are obtainable from Freemasons Hall, London. They will really bring this tape to life.